Ming was back inside in less than 5 minutes, with the fine porcelain cups on a decorated serving tray. She presented the morning drinks to both men with an elegance that earned her a thank you from her boss, and then she took her leave. Ren, she saw, wasn't any happier to be in with her minister.
"What is the problem, Ren?"
"In 2 weeks I will have 1,000 workers with nothing to do, Fang."
"Oh? What is the reason for that, my friend?"
"I do much business with an American business. It is called Butterfly. They sell clothing to wealthy American women.
My factory outside Shanghai makes the cloth, and my tailoring plant at Yangcheng turns the fabric into clothing, which we ship to America and Europe. We've been doing business with Butterfly for 3 years now, very satisfactorily for all concerned."
"Yes? So what then is the difficulty?"
"Fang Butterfly just cancelled an order worth $140 million. They did it without any warning. Only last week they told us how happy they were with our products. We've invested a fortune into quality control to make sure they would stay with us. But they've left us like a dog in the street."
"Why did this happen, Ren?" Minister Fang asked, fearing he knew the answer.
"Our representative in New York tells us that it's because of the deaths of the two clergymen. He tells us that Butterfly had no choice, that Americans demonstrated outside his establishment in New York and prevented people from going inside to buy his wares. He says that Butterfly cannot do business with me for fear of having their own business collapse."
"Do you not have a contract with them? Are they not obligated to honor it?"
Ren nodded.
"Technically, yes, but business is a practical thing, Minister. If they cannot sell our goods, then they will not buy them from us. They cannot get the financing to do so from their bankers. Bankers loan money in the expectation that it will be paid back, yes?"
"There is an escape clause in the contract. We could dispute it in court, but it would take years, and we would probably not succeed. And it would also offend others in the industry, and thus prevent us from ever doing business in New York again. So in practical terms, there is no remedy."
"Is this a temporary thing? Surely this difficulty will pass, will it not?"
"Fang, we also do business in Italy, with the House of D'Alberto, a major trendsetter in European fashion. They also cancelled their relationship with us. It seems that the Italian man our police killed comes from a powerful and influential family. Our representative in Italy says that no Chinese firm will be able to do business there for some time. In other words, Minister, that unfortunate incident with the churchman is going to have grave consequences."
"But these people have to purchase their cloth somewhere," Fang objected.
"Indeed they do. And they will do so in Thailand, Singapore, and Taiwan."
"Is that possible?"
Ren nodded quickly and sadly.
"It is very possible. Sources have told me that they are busily contacting our former business partners to take up the slack, as they put it. You see, the Taiwan government has launched an aggressive campaign to distinguish themselves from us, and it would appear that their campaign is, for the moment, highly successful."
"Well, Ren, surely you can find other customers for your goods?" Fang suggested with confidence.
But the industrialist shook his head. He hadn't touched his tea, and his eyes looked like wounds in a stone head.
"Minister, America is the world's largest such market, and it appears it will soon be closed to us. After that is Italy, and that door also has been slammed shut. Paris, London, even the avant-garde marketers in Denmark and Vienna will not even return our phone calls. I've had my representative contact all potential markets, and they all say the same thing. No one wants to do business with China. Only America could save us, but America will not."
"What will this cost you?"
"As I told you, $140 million just from the Butterfly account alone, and another similar amount from our other American and European businesses."
Fang didn't have to think long to calculate the take the PRC's government got from that.
"Your colleagues?"
"I have spoken with several.
The news is the same. The timing could hardly be worse. All of our contracts are coming due at the same time. We are talking billions of dollars, Minister. Billions, he repeated.
Fang lit a cigarette. I see, he said. But what would it take to fix this?
Something to make America happy, not just the government, but the citizens too.
Is that truly important? Fang asked, somewhat tiredly. He'd heard this rubbish so many times from so many voices.
Fang, in America, people can buy their clothing from any number of stores and manufacturers, any number of marketers. The people choose which succeeds and which fails. Women's clothing in particular is an industry as volatile as vapor. It does not take much to make such a company fail. As a result, those companies will not assume additional and unnecessary risks. To do business with the People's Republic now, today, is something they see as an unnecessary risk.
Fang took a drag and thought about that. It was actually something he'd always known intellectually, but never quite appreciated. America was a different place, and it did have different rules. And since China wanted American money, China had to abide by those rules. That wasn't politics. That was practicality.
So you want me to do what?
Please tell your fellow ministers that this could mean financial ruin for us. Certainly for my industry, and we are a valuable asset for our country. We bring wealth into China. If you want that wealth to spend on other things, then you must pay attention to what we need in order to get you that wealth.
What Ren could not say was that he and his fellow industrialists were the ones who made the Politburo's economic, and therefore also political, agenda possible, and that therefore the Politburo needed to listen to them once in a while. But Fang knew what the Politburo would say in reply.
A horse may pull the cart, but you do not ask the horse where it wishes to go. Such was political reality in the People's Republic of China. Fang knew that Ren had been around the world, that he had a sizable personal fortune which the PRC had graciously allowed him to accumulate, and that, probably more important, he had the intelligence and personal industry to thrive anywhere he chose to live. Fang knew also that Ren could fly to Taiwan and get financing to build a factory there, where he could employ others who looked and spoke Chinese, and he'd make money there and get some political influence in the bargain. Most of all, he knew that Ren knew this.
Would he act upon it?
Probably not. He was Chinese, a citizen of the mainland. This was his land, and he had no desire to leave it. Else he would not be here now, pleading his case to the one minister. Well, probably Chiang Kun would listen also, whose ear might be receptive to his words. Ren was a patriot, but not a communist. What an odd duality that was.
Fang stood. This meeting had gone far enough.
I will do this, my friend, he told his visitor, and I will let you know what develops.
Thank you, Comrade Minister.
Ren bowed and took his leave, not looking better, but pleased that someone had actually listened to him. Listening was not what one expected of Politburo members. Fang sat back down and lit another cigarette, then reached for his tea. He thought for a minute or so.
Ming! He called loudly.
It took 7 seconds by his watch.
Yes, Minister.
What news articles do you have for me? He asked. His secretary disappeared for another few seconds, then reappeared, holding a few pages.
Here, Minister, just printed up. This one may be of particular interest.
This one was a cover story from the Wall Street Journal. Major shift in China business, it proclaimed. The question mark was entirely rhetorical. He saw in the first paragraph. Ren was right. He had to discuss this with the rest of the Politburo. The second major item in Bondarenko's morning was observing tank gunnery. His men had the newest variant of the T-80UM main battle tank. It wasn't quite the newest T-99 that was just coming into production. This UM did, however, have a decent fire control system, which was novel enough. The target range was about as simple as one could ask. Large white cardboard panels with black tank silhouettes painted on them. And they were set at fixed, known ranges. Many of his gunners had never fired a live round since leaving gunnery school. Such was the current level of training in the Russian army, the general fumed. Then he fumed some more. He watched one particular tank firing at a target an even 1,000 meters away. It should have been mere spitting distance, but as he watched, first one, then two more of the tracer rounds missed, all falling short, until the fourth shot hit high on the painted turret shape. With that feat accomplished, the tank shifted aim to a second target at 1,200 meters and missed that one twice, before achieving a pinwheel in the geometric center of the target. "Nothing wrong with that?" Aliyev said next to him.
"Except that the tank and the crew were all dead 90 seconds ago," Bondarenko observed, followed by a particularly vile oath. "Ever see what happens when a tank blows up? Nothing left of the crew but sausage. Expensive sausage."
"It's their first time in a live-fire exercise," Aliyev said, hoping to calm his boss down.
"We have limited practice ammunition, and it's not as accurate as war shots." "How many live rounds do we have?"
Aliyev smiled.
"Millions."
They had, in fact, warehouses full of the things, fabricated back in the 1970s.
"Then issue them," the general ordered.
"Moscow won't like it," the colonel warned. War shots were, of course, far more expensive.
"I am not here to please them, Andrei Petrovich. I am here to defend them."
And some day he'd meet the fool who'd decided to replace the tank's loader crewman with a machine. It was slower than a soldier, and removed a crewman who could assist in repairing damage. Didn't engineers ever consider that tanks were actually supposed to go into battle? No, this tank had been designed by a committee, as all Soviet weapons had been, which explained perhaps why so many of them didn't work, or just as badly didn't protect their users. Like putting the gas tank inside the doors of the BTR armored personnel carrier. Whoever thought that a crewman might want to bail out of a damaged vehicle and perhaps even survive to fight afoot? The tank's vulnerability had been the very first thing the Afghans had learned about Soviet mobile equipment, and how many Russian boys had burned to death because of it.
"Well," Bondarenko thought, "I have a new country now. And Russia does have talented engineers, and in a few years perhaps we can start building weapons worthy of the soldiers who carry them." "Andrei, is there anything in our command which does work?"
"That's why we are training, Comrade General."
Bondarenko's service reputation was of an upbeat officer who looked for solutions rather than problems. His operations officer supposed that Gennady Yosifovich was overwhelmed by the scope of the difficulties, not yet telling himself that however huge a problem was, it had to be composed of numerous small ones which could be addressed one at a time. Gunnery, for example. Today it was execrable. But in a week it would be much better, especially if they gave the troops real rounds instead of the practice ones. Real bullets, as soldiers invariably call them, made you feel like a man instead of a schoolboy with his workbook. There was much to be said for that, and like many of the things his new boss was doing, it made good sense. In 2 weeks they'd be watching more tank gunnery, and seeing more hits than misses. Chapter 40 Fashion Statements.
"So, George?" Ryan asked.
"So it started. Turns out there are a ton of similar contracts coming due for the next season or something, plus Christmas toy contracts,
Sectrez told his president. And it's not just us. Italy, France, England, everybody's bugging out on them. The Chinese have made huge inroads into that industry, and they pissed off a lot of people in the process. Well, the chicken hasn't so much come home to roost as it's flown the coop, and that leaves our friends in Beijing holding the bag. It's a big bag, Jack. We're talking billions here. How badly will that hurt them? Sextate asked. Scott, I grant you it seems a little odd that the fate of a nation could ride on Victoria's Secret brassieres, but money is money. They need it, and all of a sudden there's a big hole in their current account. How big? Billions. It's going to make a hell of a bellyache for them. Any actual harm? Ryan asked. Not my department, Jack, Winston answered. That's Scott. Okay. Ryan turned his head to look at his other cabinet member. Before I can answer that, I need to know what net effect this will have on the Chinese economy. Winston shrugged. Theoretically, they could ride this out with minimal difficulties, but that depends on how they make up the shortfall. Their national industrial base is an incredibly muddled hodgepodge of private and state-owned industries. The private ones are the efficient ones, of course, and the worst of the state-owned industries belong to their army. I've seen analyses of PLA operations that look like something out of Mad Magazine, just impossible to credit on first reading. Soldiers don't generally know much about making things. They're better at breaking them. And tossing Marxism into the mix doesn't exactly help the situation. So those enterprises piss away vast quantities of cash. If they shut those down or just cut them back, they could kiss this little shortfall off and move on. But they won't.
That's right, Adler agreed. The Chinese People's Liberation Army has a lot of political clout over there. The party controls it, but the tail wags the dog to a considerable extent. There's quite a bit of political and economic unrest over there. They need the army to keep things under control, and the PLA takes a big cut off the top of the national treasure because of that.
The Soviets weren't like that, POTUS objected. Different country, different culture. Keep that in mind.
Klingons, Ryan muttered with a nod.
Okay, go on.
Winston took the lead.
We can't predict the impact this will have on their society without knowing how they're going to react to the cash shortfall.
If they squeal when it starts to hurt, what do we do? Ryan asked next.
They're going to have to make nice, like reinstating the Boeing and Caterpillar orders and doing it publicly.
They won't. They can't, Adler objected. Too much loss of face. Asian mindset. That won't happen. They might offer us concessions, but they'll have to be hidden ones.
Which is not politically acceptable to us. If I try to take that to Congress, first they'll laugh at me, then they'll crucify me.
Ryan took a sip of his drink.
And they won't understand why you can't tell Congress what to do. They think you're a strong leader, and therefore you're supposed to make decisions on your own,
Eagle informed his president.
Don't they know anything about how our government works? POTUS asked.
Jack, I'm sure they have all sorts of experts who know more about the constitutional process than I do, but the Politburo members are not required to listen to them. They come from a very different political environment, and that's the one they understand. For us, the people means popular opinion, polls, and ultimately elections. For them, it means the peasants and workers who are supposed to do what they're told.
We do business with these people? Winston asked the ceiling.
It's called realpolitik, George, Ryan explained.
But we can't pretend they don't exist. There's over a billion of them, and, oh, by the way, they also have nuclear weapons, on ballistic launchers even,
which added a decidedly unpleasant element to the overall equation.
12 of them, according to CIA, and we can turn their country into a parking lot if we have to.
Just it'll take 24 hours instead of 40 minutes, Ryan told his guests, managing not to get a chill when he said it. The possibility was too remote to make him nervous.
And they know that. And who wants to be the king of a parking lot?
They are that rational, Scott, aren't they?
I think so. They rattle their saber at Taiwan, but not even much of that lately. Not when we have 7th Fleet there all the time. Which, however, burned up a lot of fuel oil for the Navy.
Anyway, this cash problem won't actually cripple their economy, Jack asked.
I don't think so, unless they're pretty damn dumb.
Scott, are they dumb? Ryan asked State Department.
Not that dumb. At least, I don't think so, State told the President.
Good. Then I can go upstairs and have another drink.
Ryan rose, and his guests did the same.
This is lunacy,
Chun Kun growled at Fang half a world away, discussing what turned out to be the same set of issues.
I will not disagree with you, Chun, but we must make our case to the rest of our colleagues. Fang, this could mean ruin for us. With what shall we buy wheat and oil?
What are our reserves? The finance minister had to sit back and think about that one. He closed his eyes and tried to remember the numbers on which he got briefed the first Monday of every month. The eyes opened.
The harvest from last year was better than average. We have food for about a year, assuming an average harvest this year, or even a slightly short one. The immediate problem is oil. We've been using a lot of that lately, with the PLA's constant exercises up north and on the coast. In oil we have perhaps 4 months in reserve, and the money to purchase another 2 months. After that we will have to cut back our uses. Now we are self-sufficient in coal, and so we'll have all the electricity we need. The lights will burn, the trains will run, but the PLA will be crippled.
Not that this is an entirely bad thing, he didn't add.
Both men acknowledged the value of the People's Liberation Army, but today it was really more of a domestic security service, like a large and well-armed police force, than a real guarantor of their national security, which had really no external threats to deal with.
The Army won't like that, Fang warned.
I am not overly concerned with their likes and dislikes, Fang, the finance minister countered.
We have a country to bring out of the 19th century. We have industries to grow and people to feed and employ. The ideology of our youth has not been as successful in bringing this about as we were educated to expect.
Do you say that? Xian shifted in his chair.
Remember what Deng said? It doesn't matter if the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. And Mao exiled him soon thereafter. And so today we have 200 million more mouths to feed. But the only additional funds with which we do it came to us from the black cat, not the white one.
We live in a practical world, Fang. I too have my copy of the Little Red Book, but I've never tried to eat it.
This former railroad engineer had been captured by his bureaucracy and his job, just like the last one had been. He'd died at the relatively young age of 78, before he could be expelled from his Politburo chair. Qian, a youthful 66, would have to learn to watch his words and his thoughts more carefully. He was about to say so when Qian started speaking again.
Fang, people like you and me, we must be able to speak freely to one another. We are not college students full of revolutionary zeal. We are men of years and knowledge, and we must have the ability to discuss issues frankly. We waste too much time in our meetings kneeling before Mao's cadaver. The man is dead, Fang. Yes, he was a great man. Yes, he was a great leader for our people, but no, he wasn't the Lord Buddha, or Jesus, or whatever. He was only a man, and he had ideas, and most of them were right. But some of them were wrong, some of them don't work. The great leap forward accomplished nothing. And the Cultural Revolution, in addition to killing off undesirable intellectuals and troublemakers, also starved millions of our people to death. And that is not desirable, is it?
That is true, my young friend. But it is important how you present your ideas,
Fung warned his junior, non-voting member of the Politburo. Present them stupidly, and you'll find yourself counting rice bags on a collective farm. He was a little old to go barefoot into the paddies, even as punishment for ideological apostasy.
"Will you support me?" Chan asked.
"I will try," was the half-hearted answer. He had to plead Ren Heping's case as well this day, and it wouldn't be easy. They'd counted on the funds transfer at Qian's ministry. They had contracts to pay for. The tanker had long since been scheduled because they were booked well in advance, and this carrier was just now coming alongside the loading pier off the coast of Iran. She'd load 456,000 tons of crude oil over a period of less than a day, then steam back out of the Persian Gulf, turn southeast for the passage around India, then transit the crowded Malacca Strait past Singapore and north to the huge and newly built oil terminal at Shanghai, where she'd spend 30 or 40 hours offloading the cargo, then retrace her journey back to the Gulf for yet another load in an endless procession. Except that the procession wasn't quite endless. It would end when the money stopped, because the sailors had to be paid, the debt on the tanker serviced, and most of all the oil had to be bought. And it wasn't just one tanker. There were quite a few of them on the China run. A satellite focused on just that one segment of the world's oil trade would have seen them from a distance, looking like cars on a highway going to and from the same 2 points continuously. And like cars, they didn't have to go merely between those 2 places. There were other ports at which to load oil, and others at which to offload it. And to the crews of the tankers, the places of origin and destination didn't really matter very much, because almost all of their time was spent at sea. And the sea was always the same. Nor did it matter to the owners of the tankers, or the agents who did the chartering. What mattered was that they got paid for their time. For this charter, the money had been wire-transferred from one account to another. And so the crew stood at their posts watching the loading process, monitoring it mainly by watching various dials and gauges. You couldn't see the oil going through the pipes, after all. Various crew members were on the beach to see to the victualling of their ship, and to visit the chandlers to get books and magazines to read, video cassette movies, and drink to go with the food, plus whatever consumable supplies had been used up on the inbound trip. A few crewmen looked for women whose charms might be rented, but that was an iffy business in Iran. None of them knew or thought very much about who paid for their services. Their job was to operate the ship safely and efficiently. The ship's officers mainly had their wives along, for whom the voyages were extended, if rather boring, pleasure cruises. Every modern tanker had a swimming pool and a deck for tanning, plus satellite TV for news and entertainment. And none of them particularly cared where the ship went, because for the women, shopping was shopping, and any new port had its special charms. This particular tanker, the World Progress, was chartered out of London, and had 5 more Shanghai runs scheduled until the charter ran out. The charter was paid, however, on a per-voyage basis, and the funds for this trip had been wired only 7 days before. That was hardly a matter of concern for the owners or the ship's agent. After all, they were dealing with a nation-state, whose credit tended to be good. In due course, the loading was completed. A computerized system told the ship's first officer that the ship's trim was correct, and he so notified the master, who then told the chief engineer to wind up the ship's gas turbine engines. This engine type made things easy, and in less than 5 minutes the ship's power plant was fully ready for sea. 20 minutes after that, powerful harbor tugs eased the ship away from the loading dock. This evolution is the most demanding for a tanker's crew because only in confined waters is the risk of collision and serious damage quite so real. But within 2 hours the tanker was underway under her own power, heading for the narrows at Bandar Abbas and then the open sea.
Yes, Chan, Premier Xu said tiredly. Proceed.
Comrades, at our last meeting I warned you of a potential problem of no small proportions. That problem is with us now, and it is growing larger.
Are we running out of money, Chan? Zhang Hansan asked, with a barely concealed smirk. The answer amused him even more.
Yes, Zhang, we are.
How can a nation run out of money? The senior Politburo member demanded.
The same way a factory worker can, by spending more than he has. Another way is to offend his boss and lose his job.
We have done both, Chan replied evenly.
What boss do we have? Zhang inquired, with a disarming and eerie gentleness.
Comrades, that is what we call trade. We sell our goods to others in return for money, and we use that money to purchase goods from those others. Since we are not peasants from ancient times, bartering a pig for a sheep, we must use money, which is the means of international exchange. Our trade with America has generated an annual surplus on the order of $70 billion.
Generous of the foreign devils, Premier Xu observed to Zhang sotto voce,
which we have almost entirely spent for various items, largely for our colleagues in the People's Liberation Army of late. Most of these are long-term purchase items for which advance payment was necessary, as is normal in the international arms business. To this, we must add oil and wheat. There are other things which are important to our economy, but we will concentrate on these for the moment.
Chan looked around the table for approval.
He got it, though Marshal Luo Kong, defense minister, and commander-in-chief of the People's Liberation Army, and lord of the PLA's sizable industrial empire, was now looking on with a gimlet eye. The expenditures of his personal empire had been singled out, and that was not calculated to please him.
Comrades, Chan continued, we now face the loss of much, perhaps most, of that trade surplus with America, and other foreign countries as well. You see these? He held up a fistful of telexes and email printouts. These are cancellations of commercial business orders and funds transfers. Let me clarify. These are billions of lost dollars, money which in some cases we have already spent, but money we will never have because we have angered those with whom we do business.
You tell me that they have such power over us? Rubbish, another member observed.
Comrade, they have the power to buy our trade goods for cash or not buy them for cash. If they choose not to buy them, we do not get the money we need to spend for Marshal Luo's expensive toys.
He used that word deliberately. It was time to explain the facts of life to these people, and a slap across the face was sure to get their attention.
Now let us consider wheat. We use wheat to make bread and noodles. If you have no wheat, you have no noodles. Our country does not grow enough wheat to feed our people. We know this. We have too many mouths to feed. In a few months, the great producing countries, America, Canada, Australia, Argentina, and so forth, they will all have wheat to sell. But with what shall we buy it? Marshal Luo, your army needs oil to refine into diesel fuel and jet fuel, does it not? We need the same things for our diesel trains and our airlines. But we cannot produce all the oil we need for our domestic needs, and so we must buy it from the Persian Gulf and elsewhere. Again, with what shall we buy it?
So, sell our trade goods to someone else? A member asked, with rather surprising innocence, Chan thought.
Who else might there be, comrade?
There is only one America. We have also offended all of Europe.
Whom does that leave?
Australia? They are allied to Europe and America.
Japan?
They also sell to America,
and they will move to replace our lost markets, not to buy from us. South America, perhaps. Those are all Christian countries, and we just killed a senior Christian churchman, didn't we? Moreover, in their ethical world, he died heroically. We have not just killed. We have created a holy martyr to their faith. Comrades, we have deliberately structured our industry base to sell to the American market. To sell elsewhere, we would first have to determine what they need that we can make, and then enter the market. You don't just show up with a boatload of products and exchange it for cash on the dock. It takes time and patience to become a force in such a market. Comrades, we have cast away the work of decades. The money we are losing will not come back for years, and until then, we must learn to live our national life differently.
What are you saying? Zhang shot back. I am saying that the People's Republic faces economic ruin because two of our policemen killed those two meddling churchmen.
That is not possible. It is not possible, Zhang. If you offend the man who gives you money, then he will give you no more. Can you understand that? We've gone far out of our way to offend America, and then we offended all of Europe as well. We have made ourselves outcasts. They call us barbarians because of that unhappy incident at the hospital. I do not defend them, but I must tell you what they say and think. And as long as they say those things and think those things, it is we who will pay for the error. I refuse to believe this, Zhang insisted.
That is fine. You may come to my ministry and add up the numbers yourself.
Chan was feeling full of himself, Fang saw. Finally, he had them listening to him. Finally, he had them thinking about his thoughts and his expertise.
Do you think I make this story up to tell in some country inn over rice wine?
Then it was Premier Xu, leaning forward and thinking aloud.
You have our attention, Qian. What can we do to avert this difficulty?
Having delivered his primary message quickly and efficiently, Shan Kun didn't know what to say now. There wasn't a way to avert it that these men would accept. But having given them a brief taste of the harsh truth, now he had to give them some more.
We need to change the perception of American minds. We need to show them that we are not what they consider barbarians. We have to transform our image in their eyes. For starters, we must make amends for the deaths of those two priests.
Abase ourselves before the foreign devils? Never! Zhang snarled.
Comrade Zhang, Fang said, coming carefully to Chan's defense. Yes, we are the Middle Kingdom, and no, we are not the barbarians. They are. But sometimes one must do business with barbarians. And that might mean understanding their point of view and adapting to it somewhat.
Humble ourselves before them?
Yes, Zhang. We need what they have, and to get it we must be acceptable to them.
And when they next demand that we make political changes, then what?
This was the Premier Xu, getting somewhat agitated, which was unusual for him.
We face such decisions when and if they come, Qian answered, pleasing Fang, who didn't want to risk saying that himself.
We cannot risk that, the Interior Minister, Tong Jie, responded, speaking for the first time. The police of the nation belonged to him, and he was responsible for civil order in the country. Only if he failed would he call upon Marshal Luo, which would cause him both loss of face and loss of power at this table. In a real sense, the deaths of the two men had been laid at his place, for he had generated the formal orders on the suppression of religious activity in the PRC, increasing the harshness of law enforcement in order to increase the relative influence of his own ministry.
If the foreigners insist upon internal political changes, it could bring us all down.
And that was the core issue Fang saw at once.
The People's Republic rested absolutely upon the power of the party and its leaders,
these men before him in this room. Like noblemen of old, each was attended by a trusted servant, sitting in the chairs against the wall, around the table, waiting for the order to fetch tea or water. Each had his rationale for power, whether it was defense, or interior, or heavy industry, or in his particular case, friendship and general experience. Each had labored long and hard to reach this point, and none of them relished the thought of losing what he had, any more than a provincial governor under the Qing dynasty would have willingly reverted to being a mere mandarin, because that meant at least ignominy, and, just as likely, death. These men knew that if a foreign country demanded and got internal political concessions, then their grip on power would loosen, and that was the one thing they dared not risk. They ruled the workers and peasants, and because of that they also feared them. The noblemen of old could fall back upon the teachings of Confucius or Buddha, on a spiritual foundation for their temporal power. But Marx and Mao had swept all that away, leaving only force as their defense. And if to maintain their country's prosperity they had to diminish that force, what would then happen? They didn't know. And these men feared the unknown as a child feared the evil monsters under his bed at night, but with far more reason. It had happened right here in Beijing, not all that many years before. Not one of these men had forgotten it. To the public, they'd always shown steadfast determination. But each of them, alone in his bathroom before the mirror, or lying in bed at night before sleep came, had shown fear. Because, though they basked in the devotion of the peasants and workers, somehow each of them knew that the peasants and workers might fear them, but also hated them. Hated them for their arrogance, their corruption, for their privilege, their better food, their luxurious housing, their personal servants. Their servants, they all knew, loathed them as well, behind smiles and bows of obeisance, which could just as easily conceal a dagger, because that's how the peasants and workers had felt about the nobles of 100 years before. The revolutionaries had made use of that hatred against the class enemies of that age, and new ones, they all knew, could make use of the same silent rage against themselves. And so they would cling to power with the same desperation as the nobles of old, except they would show even more ruthlessness, because unlike the nobles of old, they had no place to run to. Their ideology had trapped them in their golden cages more surely than any religion could. Fang had never before considered all of these thoughts in toto. Like the others, he'd worried a lot when the college students had demonstrated, building up their Goddess of Liberty out of plaster or papier-mâché. Fang didn't remember, though he did remember his sigh of relief when the PLA had destroyed it. It came as a surprise to him, the realization of how snared he was here in this place. The power he and his colleagues exercised was like something shown before a mirror that could be turned on them all instantly under the proper circumstances. They had immense power over every citizen in their country, but that power was all an illusion. And no, they couldn't allow another country to dictate political practices to them, because their lives all depended on that illusion. It was like smoke on a calm day, seemingly a pillar to hold up the heavens. But the slightest wind could blow it all away, and then the heavens would fall. On them all. But Fang also saw that there was no way out. If they didn't change to make America happy, then their country would run out of wheat and oil, and probably other things as well. And they would risk massive social change in a groundswell from below. But if to prevent that, they allowed some internal changes, they would just be inviting the same thing on themselves.